Welcome back to another episode of Vendée Radio. Tonight, it's a great pleasure to welcome back two former guests for what is the first three-way discussion. I'm looking forward to this. First of all, we have our fellow researcher and podcaster, Mr. Tim Kelly. He is the host of Our Interesting Times and Power and Principalities, which has been has offered particularly cogent analysis of current events and particularly brought to light some of the discrepancies, shall we say, at the least, in the official COVID-19 pandemic narrative. It's also a great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Jesse Russell. Dr. Jesse Russell will be well known to frequent listeners of Vendée Radio. He's appeared a number of times. He is also a researcher and also a podcaster. And he is also a journalist, having written for Crisis Magazine, The Remnant Newspaper, One Piece of Five, and several other publications. So good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening, Theo. Thank you so much for having me on. Congratulations. Your YouTube channel has taken off, it seems, over the past year. And it's a tremendous honor to be on here with Tim Kelly, who I've seen, in all sincerity, before we started recording, is one of the best researchers out there.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I corroborate that. Yeah, your power of recall, Tim, in your interviews always really impresses me. The things that you bring up, statistics, there's clearly a lot of preparation that goes into your programs, or you just have a photographic memory. But thank you very much for your words, Dr. Russell. I mean, success in the number of views is clearly down to the quality of the guests that share their time with me. So that I owe that to both of you as well. So tonight I wanted to discuss the coronavirus, the COVID-19 pandemic. This is clearly the kind of historical event of our time. It's notable on many different levels. I think the global nature of this event is truly unprecedented, the way that it's leading to a transformation in all of our lives. And it's really, I think, should be situated in a new phase in a cosmic struggle between celestial and infernal forces. We Catholics know in history that along with the hand of God, we also see the hand of the devil, who is always rivaling and trying to frustrate the divine plans in order to realize his own hellish projects. And I think I'll just begin, I suppose, by quoting Professor Roberto Di Mattei. And he said that after the failure of the great illusions that opened the 20th century, the revolutionary forces are now fostering a scenario of profound mental and social chaos. 6 months after its explosion, the coronavirus's greatest consequence until now has not been in the health or social realms, but in the psychological order. No one knows what to think, and often opposing thoughts follow one another, as in cases of cognitive dissonance. In a persuasive article penned by the sociologist Luca Ricolfi in a Roman daily, he writes that the ground where the most radical changes are taking place is in the way our minds work. The most evident change is uncertainty, which is not only the difficulty found in planning for the future, but is a generalized state of mental anarchy. The regime of mental anarchy triggered by COVID-19, writes Ricolfi, is perilous for social cohesion, since the life of society is held together by common rules and shared patterns in perceptions of reality. But it is also perilous for the psychological equilibrium of the individual, since a world in which everyone sees what they want to see without regard for what others see is tremendously destabilizing and anxiety-inducing, end quote. So I think that touches on a really important theme here, which is the general diabolical disorientation that we see at this time. So I'm sure that you gentlemen will be able to shed a lot of light on what's going on here and why our lives are being transformed for a disease that is only fatal in exceptional cases. Maybe even possibly it's burned out, but it's indisputable that it has very minimal mortality. So I guess let's start with the nature of COVID-19 and the so-called pandemic.
Well, the pandemic was declared on March 11th, by Dr. Tedros. He was the General Secretary of the World Health Organization. And at the time, there were only 150 known cases outside China. A lot of reports coming from China that there was this outbreak. They had locked down tens of millions of people. I don't know if that's true or not, because it's China, and it's also the mainstream media reporting this. And these efforts were praised by the World Health Organization, and it became a model for the response in the West. So basically, the response in the West is mimicking the communist Chinese regime, which isn't exactly encouraging, nor should it be edifying. But the basis for the pandemic, of course, there's no clear definition of what a pandemic is. Now it's not people dying, it's just people reported cases. And we also had sensational reports out of Italy early on, which has since been exposed as being exaggerated, false. The same thing with false reporting, dying with COVID as opposed to dying of COVID. Average age was, I think, was 74 in Italy. Question whether these people were dying anyway, so there's the nature of the diseases in question, even its mere existence, its very existence, because the virus has never been isolated. And the CDC just came out last week saying they have no available sample of an isolate of the virus itself. So I don't know how they're going to develop this vaccine that they call. They call it a vaccine, but it's something, at least one of it, which is an RNA altering vaccine that they call it. I think they want to combat it. That's, I think, the Moderna company, who's never produced a vaccine, is being given hundreds of millions of dollars to produce that. So there is profound. I think there is a lot of controversy over the nature of the disease, even its existence. Although some people don't have to go that far, you're relying on the CDC, the World Health Organization, to tell us that it exists. And these are two bodies that don't really deserve our confidence, given the scandals that they've been embroiled in over the many years. The fake 2009 pandemic that they declared over the so-called swine flu. And there is a lot of problem, the nature of these diseases, the nature of disease itself, whether or not these are caused by viruses or bacteria or toxins or environmental bad air. It is interesting that the initial outbreaks were in areas with very bad, low quality air. Air pollution problems, and that could have been the basis for it. China itself reports 300,000 deaths a year just from pneumonia, with millions of cases, and the symptoms are very general. So sometimes they blame a virus when they've really haven't done the science to prove that the virus is the causal factor in these things. So the science is really murky. It's very sloppy once you do the research. These supposed scientific institutions and doctors are being very sloppy with their science. They call it science. It came out in the spring that they were producing fraudulent death certificates. This was done to boost the numbers. This has been admitted. Dr. Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force herself, admitted that the doctors are being instructed to be very liberal or very generous on their death certificates. We had the doctor in Minnesota, Dr. Jenning, I think is his name, who said that they were falsely reporting it. They were instructed to attribute deaths to COVID-19 just because they tested positive for COVID-19. The corpse tested positive for COVID-19, or they were given a COVID-19 test as they were dying. You know, just say you get hit by a bus or you get a motorcycle accident and they test you for COVID, you die. And they say COVID-19 was the cause of this thing. And just very recently, past couple of weeks, it was announced that of the 170 or was it 190,000 reported deaths in the United States, only 9,000 could be attributed solely to COVID. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority had two or three comorbidities. And then there's a problem with the testing itself. There is no reliable COVID-19 test. It's SARS-CoV-2, and COVID-19 is supposedly the disease you get from SARS-CoV-2. But the antibody tests and this PCR test, which the developer of Kerry Mullis said that it should be used for diagnostic purposes, and yet they're using it for diagnostic purposes. And if you get in the particulars of the testing, that it doesn't count the virus load, and makes no connection between the existence of said virus and the disease itself. There's never been any blind testing for this test. So it's not a reliable test for these things. But the more tests you do, the more cycles you run, the more positive tests you get. And the New York Times admitted a couple of weeks ago that false positives could be ranged as high as 90%. And this is the basis for quarantining people, keeping people from getting employed, shutting down the economy. And then also we have the problem, the fact to date, there is no higher mortality rate, meaning that if you do have a pandemic of a deadly disease, you think you'd have an excess mortality rate. We're not seeing an excess mortality rate. I think we're slightly lower than last year. And this came out in Italy, too. Italy has reported more deaths between January and March of 2019 than January and March of 2020, despite the fact that supposedly they were having this horrible outbreak in Italy. So the nature of disease is highly questionable. The timing, which is interesting, because you had when the disease was first being reported on in January of 2020, this coincided, roughly coincided with a few months before, you had this drill or tabletop exercise, Event 201, that was sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Johns Hopkins University, in conjunction with various organizations like the World Health Organization and various universities where they had this drill of a coronavirus outbreak. I think in this case it started in South America, but it pretty much mimicked what really happened in the following months, other than that you didn't have 65 million people die.
Did it start with bat soup as well?
I think it was, and it wasn't bat soup. I think it was a pig farm or something. I don't know, something like that. But the problem with that, of course, you have the actual outbreak, and there you have Bill Gates taking center stage in this thing, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation there is offering up his whiz-bang vaccine to solve the problem. Within that Event 201, you kind of saw how this thing was going to be played out, because they drill coordinating, having focal points or contacts with media, various governments, agents or focal points within these governments to coordinate their response. Now, you could infer from that this was the actual drill to carry out the exercise, and this is how the pandemic was created. And I think it was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. who pointed out that if the reporting methods of deaths that had been in place between 2002 and 2019 had been in place in 2020, 90% of the reported deaths in the United States would go away. So by just using the old standards, you do away with the pandemic, just to using the old standards, which again suggests that this thing really is an artifact of statistical ledger domain or manipulation. There is no real pandemic other than what the media tells you. It goes back to your idea of what reality is. And so many people in the modern world get their idea of reality from the box on the wall, the TV, the idiot box. And they're being brainwashed to believe in it, to be fearful, despite the fact that the very experts they watch on the TV have given them contradictory advice within weeks. Yet this – no one calls them out on this, and when they do, it's not really carried through. It doesn't make everyone really pause and think about it. They're just simply taking instructions because they've been brainwashed or conditioned to accept instructions for so many years now. So yeah, the nature of disease is very problematic, because one thing is its lethality is dubious. Its existence is dubious, because you're dealing with a sort of biomedical mysticism, because you're supposed to believe in an invisible virus, a phantom virus that the experts tell us it exists. But one thing we know is the experts cannot be trusted, because the CDC and the World Health Organization are compromised, to say the least. So that's where we are. What is the reality of the situation? But one thing is we are certain is that, of course, the death rate is very, very low. I believe you have roughly a 99.98% chance of survival if this thing does exist. Now, how does that justify a global economic lockdown, quarantining people, shutting down society, pretty much suspending civil society, closing churches, closing schools, depriving people of social intercourse, So something else is afoot. I mean, just simply the response was so over the top. It wasn't irresponsibility. It wasn't panic. This thing was planned out, and you know, this thing was foreseen a decade ago with the Rockefeller Foundation and their lockstep document, where they planned this very thing out. And you can see this where they're laying it out. And it's funny that the objectives of Agenda 21, Agenda 2030, and sustainable development are all being achieved through the COVID-19 scandemic, which takes us back to ultimately, I think, to the World Economic Forum, the Davos set, the economic elite, Gates, you know, the crowd that Gates runs around with, and their plan for the new world. And this was the World Economic Forum's Great Reset, which was announced earlier this year, and they're going to unveil it in 2021. But they talked about it. And I think this is where the plot was hatched at the World Economic Forum with and you have this guy Klaus Schwab. If you ever see this guy interviewed, he's got a thick German accent, so he's like a great Bond villain. But he talks about restructuring the world economy. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about something like restructuring the world economy, it's kind of, you know, grandiose.
Using the opportunity.
Yeah. It's never let a crisis go to waste. And they talk about this being an opportunity to implement the Great Reset, to carry out what the revolution. And what this requires, something that grandiose, so universal, you couldn't be carried out through normal political process. You could not, like, they're going to go and, you know, lobby congressmen or lobby members of parliament and submit a bill and say, hey, this is a good idea. What do you think? No, they're going to use covert methods to do this. One thing is shutting the economy down with the pretext of a fake pandemic, and also psychological warfare and scaring everyone to death. And through this, through the immiseration of the and the impoverishment of the industrialized world, you destroy the middle class. That's what the lockdown's all about, is destroying these businesses. We wonder why so many governors and mayors seem indifferent to the suffering of their constituents. Well, if you understand the networking, how this might have been set up, then you see this with Agenda 21, with local initiatives and how local governments are suborned and infiltrated by change agents and all this. And also, in between, you have, of course, mayors and governors getting lavish with federal funds to maintain the emergency.
Mm.
So their immediate interests are being kept, and in many ways they're destroying their political opponents, because many of the small businesses that they're destroying the real economy are their political enemies. You know, a good example is what's happening in Michigan, and of course in New York. So you can infer a sort of a conspiracy from that, if you will. But this great, you know, this Great Reset, they're planning to change the global economy. You're not going to be able to do that through normal political channels. You're going to have to create a crisis, and out of chaos, a new order, you know, crisis, you know, problem, reaction, solution. And they've done it. And apparently, this is what appears to what has occurred with this crisis, because there really is no empirical evidence for a pandemic, and therefore no justification for the harsh measures and lockdowns, and therefore they should be removed immediately. And it's so bad that really you need grand jury investigations, a parliamentary investigation, extra government parliamentary investigation. They're doing this in Germany to bring charges against the people who are involved in this, and that would be various prime ministers, mayors, governors, and you know, going as high as even the executive branch in the U.S. government.
Okay, well, there's a lot to unpack there, and we're certainly going to get into some of the consequences and the so-called Great Reset. Dr. Russell, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I hope everyone brought their tinfoil hats, because I want to kind of come out of this, kind of respond to, Theo, your initial quote there from a strange angle. I have an article here. It's called, and I'll show you how this is connected with the coronavirus in just a second, but it's called The Exorcist, a CIA script. And in here, it mentions how the novel, The Exorcist, by William Blatty, that originally it could very well have been a tool of psychological warfare. Blatty had worked for the CIA in Lebanon in the 1950s under the U.S. Information Agency. And there are a number of points in the movie The Exorcist where, for example, Father Marin says, "I think the demon's target is not the possessed. It is us, the observers, every person in this house. And I is to make us despair, to reject our own humanity, to see ourselves as ultimately bestial, as ultimately vile and
putrescent, without dignity, ugly, unworthy, perhaps in our worthlessness. So this is something Tim has brought up a lot on his show, is that like we've been under this like psychological warfare for like 50 or 60 years now. We had the serial killer phenomenon, all these like horrific slasher films, and I haven't seen any of the recent horror sort of like Saw films of the post-millennial era, but I've heard that they're far more graphic and grisly than the 80s films. And this idea has been enforced. It's kind of a Lovecraftian idea that, like, there's something out there. It's terrible. It's about to get us. It's a Bond villain. It's a demon. It's Jason. It's Freddy. It's something along those lines. And we need, like, the CIA to come in, or the FBI, or the World Health, World Health Organization to come in and shut it down. I mean, there's all these disaster movies, and who's the good guys? Well, the State Department is the good guys, and the State Department's going to fix everything. Or they'll have like a movie where it's like there's a few bad apples in the CIA, but ultimately in the end, Western intelligence and Western governments are going to shut it down. So I've even seen this on a day-to-day basis, that seeing people, especially younger people who don't, you know, have this, you know, longer memory of the history of our country, that they are just absolutely terrified out of their mind. I know the Black community especially is just absolutely terrified of coronavirus. So I think absolutely this is being used as part of psychological warfare, where we will turn like children to the state to protect us. The last kind of anecdotal comment I'll make is, you know, we have such an epidemic of anxiety in our day. And what causes an increase in anxiety is restricted breathing. And what causes restricted breathing? Well, corona masks do. And so you have all these people, I know it's a small kind of incidental thing, but all these people walking around with anxiety disorders having trouble breathing because they're trying to breathe through a piece of cloth or something like that. So I think absolutely that Professor DeMattei's comment is correct. This is just a new chapter. Now it's sort of like reality in the news has been blurred. I mean, there was like... you know, is the communists going to get us, which they may well have, or whatever, then the Muslims are going to get us, and the Russians too are going to get us too in the 90s. And then now it's the coronavirus is going to get us.
And then you forget terrorism.
It's always there.
Where are the terrorists? Did the coronavirus kill them all?
Yeah, possibly.
I mean, don't people realize, I mean, why is it that we move from one boogeyman to another, that the previous boogeyman conveniently or politely walks off stage, you know.
Yeah.
Terrorism was supposed to be the long war, everlasting, but you can say these guys that blow themselves up are worried about catching a cold.
Yeah.
So it's almost like when in the springtime after the George Floyd incident, that you had all these riots and protests, mostly peaceful protests. Also, for a few weeks, all the media was talking about Black Lives Matter, defunding police, and
That was where the normies should have woken up.
But the virus went away.
Yeah, that put the lie to it. And that's what's so shocking about this so-called second wave and the kind of purchase it's having amongst the wide swathes of the population, is that the agenda was kind of revealed there, and the fact there weren't spikes in cases. But I just want to just touch on this statistical distortion, because I think it's fair to say that we're all lockdown skeptics, but I think just to maybe draw out more insight, I'm going to play the role of devil's advocate here, okay? And I'm going to express the establishment point of view for a minute. So if you do take the position, which we do, that there are different agendas leveraging whatever reality there is to this pandemic for their own nefarious ends, then how would you explain the fact that almost every country, there are notable exceptions like Sweden and Taiwan, etc., but most countries have responded very strongly to this virus, including countries that are, you would think, outside the sort of, are revisionist, slightly against the New World Order, places like Russia, etc. For there to be such a strong response from all the countries is a difficult one to answer. And I mean, if you look at somewhere like the Lombardia region, which was particularly badly hit, they had the best healthcare infrastructure in the country, one of the highest rates of intensive care units per capita in the world. But there was a period around March when the virus struck, and it was so intense that it apparently brought the system close to collapse, that it was killing an average of 12 people per day, per 100,000 inhabitants, in this epicenter. So, I mean, how would you kind of account for, this very common way that the national governments responded to the virus?
You want me to take that?
Sure.
Well, first of all, you have to assume that what's being reported is accurate, which is a problem in and of itself. We saw how CBS News was borrowing videotapes saying they think they borrowed a videotape of a hospital in Italy and said it was in New York. So the intensity of the disease could be highly exaggerated, as it was in many cases. Second of all, it's the assumption that the reported deaths or diseases that people are experiencing, respiratory illness disease, is caused by one thing, one virus. I'd be very dubious in the claim that all of a sudden, throughout the world, in various regions, that the reporting of respiratory illness and disease, flu-like symptoms, is all caused by one agent, when many things can cause that, whether it be toxins or bacterial, environmental poisons, even introduction of a new vaccine, because that does cause a reaction, and particularly in weak people, because if you give a vaccine to people who don't have an immune system, the immune system doesn't respond properly, and they get sick. And this question: were new vaccines administered in those areas at the time? I understand in Lombardy they were, so that could be a factor in that. There also was it's a very polluted area, from what I understand. Bad air. Mm-hmm. That's something that it's shared with in New York and also in China, where you have this synergy of old style industry and also new industry being mixed into the environment. In fact, they had protests in China really coming up to this outbreak about the air. It takes a lot to get people to protest in China, because the consequences can be very serious for protesting. And so this assumption that there's one cause for disease, I think, is mistaken. I mean, there's multiple causes for these things. Good example is the swine flu outbreak in 2009, which ended up being a false pandemic, which people should look into that, and that should draw in the question the legitimacy and credibility of the CDC. But they claimed it was, again, a virus, when it turns out it most likely was industrialized pollution. There is a huge pig farm in Mexico where it supposedly started, and it's a huge operation with like 900,000 pigs with not much done for sanitation. You have a lot of – in fact, they have what they call a lagoon of pig crap and urine that you can actually see from space, from what I understand. And so you have a lot of disease there, and so that's – they call it a virus. But if you call it a virus, you blame a virus, you're more or less saying God's at fault, and the industry or the company running the operation is at fault. So it's a way of avoiding liability. And that's – the CDC has an outfit called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, whose job is to find viruses and blame disease outbreaks on viruses. And that's their outlook. And they infiltrate various state agencies, media, government health services. They've been in existence since, I think, 1948 or 49. And their job is to declare war on viruses. So that's how they look at it, and that's how they educate people. And a lot of these people are programmed into thinking this way, and they'll go into the various state health institutions. They'll become state health directors. They'll go in the media. They'll become medical reporters, and this is how you control a narrative, both nationally and internationally. So that's how you coordinate a response, and you create sort of a narrative and a world view about this thing, and you can control their response that way, because everyone is a true believer in it, or is paid to believe in it. That, and also, the World Health Organization is a body of the United Nations, and it's transnational, and so it could very easily coordinate these things, as I think the evidence suggests is what did happen. Tedros himself was installed, I think, as the head of the World Health Organization after heavy lobbying by Bill Gates. And he's been in before that, he worked for a foundation that got money from Bill Gates. And so, and now I think Bill Gates is the largest donor or single donor to the World Health Organization and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So they can, you could infer from that is that Bill Gates, at least carries a lot of weight with the World Health Organization. And lo and behold, they're there creating, declaring a pandemic, which is then is going to create a situation where he's able to peddle his ID 2020 idea scheme and also his forced vaccination scheme. And again, and knows he also, and Bill Gates himself, spends billions on media. I mean, he literally will pay networks to run infomercials on his behalf. They're called interviews, but they're really infomercials on behalf of Bill Gates. And so he shows up in a pink sweater and has Sanjay Gupta interview him and throw him a softball question. So the world is treated to a college dropout telling the world, we're all treated to a college dropout telling us how we should respond to a medical problem that the experts should, that we should all bow to the experts. But the experts are being paid by Bill Gates. So so there's always an oligarch behind the technocracy, who's directing these things. We're supposed to bow at the foot of science and experts, but then it turns out the guy who's paying the experts is a college dropout with no particular knowledge in these things. That's the irony of it all.
Yeah, I'm going
to. I don't know if that's a roundabout way to answer that question. I hope they answered that question. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yes, thank you.
Okay.
I'm going to throw a couple left field things in here too, but I won't mention the Exorcist.
Can I say one thing now?
Sure.
You're right. Your comment of the Exorcist is making us feel disgusted with ourselves. Well, what do you think the virus does? We're all a bunch of walking bioweapons, right?
Yeah,
that's what it does. So we're fearful of each other's physical presence.
That's absolutely right. And they know that we need to see each other's faces. That's why people get depressed and have panic attacks on Instagram, is because they're not seeing a real human face. So the mask thing is definitely this kind of degrading, dehumanizing experience for the mask wearer. Is like a muzzled horse or something, or cow. And then like we walk around, I'm sure that must be like short circuiting something deep down inside of us to not be able to see the faces of the people we're interacting with.
I'm in a line of work, right? Interact with people. And what I'm saying now is I show up, I'm not wearing a mask. They come out with a mask on, and within 3 minutes, they take the mask off and they're talking to me.
Yeah, I've had that experience. I've also had Karen yell at me about not wearing a mask.
Yeah, we'll come on to the muzzles, the face nappies, because I think that's such an important part of this, how the hysteria is perpetuated. Just to return quickly to the statistics, I think one area amongst many that's been completely lacking.
Sorry, you're breaking up.
Sorry, can you hear me? Testing, hello?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. So I was saying that I'll continue and see if it, see, I mean, it still seems to be picking up here. One area that is not being scrutinized, is the differential statistical standards of recording deaths and cases between countries. So how on earth can you actually compare? You have these things like Worldometer with these kind of graphics of comparing, deaths and cases by countries and sort of sensationalizing the whole thing. But they're just so different. I mean, for example, Italy doesn't actually include nursing home deaths. Spain does. Every country measures in a different way. And this is something the UK's chief medical advisor, who's a, lockdown hawk, he said that comparing them one to another is a largely fruitless exercise. In Italy, the numbers are collated on a regional basis and slightly different measures are being used in different parts of the country. So in order to say that, you'd think that in this sort of globalized world, particularly somewhere like the EU, there would be standard measures, statistical measures. An April German study puts that country's COVID death rate at 0.37%. Whereas Italy, by contrast, had at one time reported headline-grabbing mortality rates near 10%. However, Bloomberg reported that more than 99% of Italy's coronavirus fatalities were people who suffered from previous medical conditions. And the average age of those who have died from the virus in Italy is 79.5. So there's a lot of the larger point that I'd like to kind of throw back to you, gentlemen, is that this information saturation, where there are so many, there's so much information out there now, particularly with the internet, that the average person is just overwhelmed by the amount of data, the amount of perspectives and opinions, that they just don't know where to turn, and so they're just befuddled. Try finding, you know, reliable information about whether, for example, children can transmit the virus, that they're contagious, or the asymptomatic people are contagious. You know, I can show you five scientific documents coming out the same day from one side and the other that claim opposite perspectives on that. So there is this kind of information overload, which makes it very difficult and leads to this stasis and people just being completely unsure what to think.
Well, I'm gonna throw out a bunch of contradictory conspiracy theories that will sort of answer that and the previous question as well. One is the possibility there is something real about coronavirus. It is some strand of the flu. It may be genetically engineered. Some people have suggested that, you know, it was engineered to target like sicker people to kind of for eugenic reasons. Other people suggested it's meant to target elderly people because they vote more conservative. I don't know if those are true. And it's something Jay Dyer has talked a lot about, is that this idea of a breakaway civilization. And we have all these films where it's like some pandemic comes about or some nuclear attack or whatever. And then like the population gets wiped out. There's kind of a real big great reset in the sense of like this could be a trial run for something further on. Now, I'll kind of contradict myself and say I've also heard that such like genetically engineering viruses would be and setting them loose would be a horrible idea because they could mutate. And then like George Soros is having a party in Switzerland and he gets a crate of champagne shipped there by a drone and somebody shipping it touched the crate and had corona on it or something like that. And then they all get it. But I think that, you know, Tim has pointed this out. I think this is kind of like to put some of the Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030 programs in place. I also think that it's trying to see what we're going to do in response to this. It's going to see like, will
like
we
a
really
mass experiment.
Yeah. Will we wear the masks? Will we obey? Will we stay inside? And what's interesting to me, and I'd like to know your guys' thoughts on this, is that certain demographics, surprisingly, do end up wearing masks and staying inside, and those who don't. Sometimes it's unexpected. And as a final point, I will say it was interesting that Fox News initially was somewhat skeptical. And so all the Fox News American conservatives were skeptical of coronavirus. Mm. And then at least some of the talking heads on Fox News started really pushing it. And then it was like flipping a switch. Then all of a sudden, even people in my family were just terrified of coronavirus who watch Fox News.
Rusty Reno at First Things was very skeptical to start with, and then he's been completely, well, he's the editor, but he's no longer skeptical. And Peter Hitchens, who is just a fairly mainstream conservative commentator who writes for First Things, was told not to question the masks and the draconian lockdown measures in First Things. So there was like a switch on that. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. First Things, this actually was something I was going to talk about, but I won't get into it now. But yeah, there's definitely been a crackdown there. In their editorials and their articles, they had some pretty, I don't want to say based, but pretty red-pilled essays in there a couple years ago, but there's definitely been a crackdown.
Okay, so let's just quickly cover the masks then. I think the mask is such a visible and is such an important feature of this crisis. I think it does two things. Firstly, it covers, as you've mentioned, Dr. Russell, it covers the Imago Dei, man's noblest feature, his face. And that, well, St. Paul says that, that we see God through a glass darkly, but then face to face. And what is a holy mass but a glimpse of heaven? And to attend the holy sacrifice of the mass, that glimpse of heaven, with the face obscured, I think is sacrilege, and I would just never do it. I refuse to do it. The second thing it does is perpetuates the idea of the reality of the pandemic. That's the really crucial thing. And Peter Hitchens said that it's kind of a form of compelled speech, because through the forced wearing of face coverings, which they publicly signal both surrender to the state and acceptance of the utopian unscientific policy which guides the state. The obvious aspect of the face mask decrees has so far eluded those who have only just begun to live as servants of citizens of a servile state. Yet I remain amazed that so many either cannot see or pretend not to see the enormous symbolism of a population compelled by fear of the state to sacrifice much of their individuality and to adopt a form of dress which is associated with submission. I sometimes wonder where all the amateur Freudians are, normally so ready to offer analysis of failings at moments such as this. Those who think the era of the face mask will soon be over might like to recall that the irrational precautions of airport security, almost wholly futile once the simple precaution of refusing to open the door to the flight deck has been introduced, have not only remained in place since September 2001, they have been intensified, yet by and large, they are almost popular. Those who mutter against them, as I sometimes do, face stern lectures from our fellow citizens, implying that we are responsible and heedless. Now a new fear, even more shapeless, invisible, perpetual than Al-Qaeda or ISIS, has arrived in our midst. Tim, is there anything you'd like to add on the face nappies?
Yeah, you're right. I think it's a sign of fear and submission. And it's also a form of humiliation, because it's nonsensical. It doesn't protect you. At least if you had a mask that was effective, the idea that mask wearing, people would wear it, you know, and use it properly, you know, is absurd. You're touching it, and it becomes itself a surface for bacteria, inhibit the breathing, disrupts your health and makes you actually more susceptible, weakens your immune system, hypoxia, these problems, if you wear these masks for any extended period of time. It's so much what propaganda is, because even propaganda, when it's crude and obvious, the fact that it's ubiquitous and it's everywhere, it's ubiquitous and means that it's sort of demoralizing if you're skeptical of it, right? Mm. And you yourself, you would just give up and go, okay, I accept it. And that's part of the function of propaganda, is that just that it will humiliate the individual, the critical thinker, because it's everywhere. It's like when you drive around, you see these signs, thank you, heroes work here, on buildings, because, yeah. You know, frontline workers, as if, you know, working at a grocery store is the same as being in battle. Frontline workers.
How many deaths have there been of supermarket employees?
Yes. So yeah, this nonsense, and you know that it's nonsense. Just today, two of my sons were going for team pictures for their little league, and it turns out that you can't do a group photo of the team, so they're going to take individual shots and Photoshop people in. Yeah, now, this is absurd. Weird. This is ridiculous. My brothers and his, where he plays, the players have to wear a mask when they play. Now I wouldn't do that. Where my kids play, they don't have to wear a mask when they play, but the coaches have to wear a mask. They can't go in the dugout, so the kids congregate just outside the dugout. they've taken the bleachers away, so people just get together with their fold out chairs and talk. I think the message, the absurdity of it is part of the message. Yeah, it's part of the cognitive dissonance that we're confronted with. And everyone's kind of rolling their eyes at it, but they're complying. because they want to have the little niche. They want to have play baseball. But again, the idea that, that players who they're throwing the ball, catching it, throwing it, they're playing, sliding into each other. You're going to worry about a group photo. Yeah. Now, what it does is if you don't question the mask, then you're not going to question the other things. But if you start to question the mask, you're not wearing the mask, then there's a cascading effect. Then you start to question the entire narrative, and it collapses. If you had a whole society said, we're not going to wear masks, they'd be much better at critically assessing the entire operation. But because they're wearing the mask, they're not able to assess this thing critically. It's the mask on, brain off effect, you know.
Yeah, it's extremely traumatizing, and we could say that, you know, we could make, you know, jokes about arena sports like the NFL, but, you know, in certain parts of the country, the only form of sort of tribalism or ethnic identity a lot of people are able to have are like SEC college football or something along those lines. And whatever we might say, this is bread and circuses, nonetheless, it allows people to come together and spend time together as families. And It's definitely, you know, extremely traumatizing. I was thinking of my YouTube, all I get ads for is like stay at home and eat Taco Bell. And I think the owner of Taco Bell and PepsiCo, I think he literally is friends with George Soros. So I could be wrong about that. But like that's the idea is you eat junk food and just sit at home. Like that's what you're supposed to do. And then they'll roll out like, you know, you can get your Yang Bucks or whatever, your $1,000 a month credits from Amazon and get Soylent from them that a drone will bring you. I think that's definitely is that it's the kind of ideas is kind of putting us asleep. So, you know, for much of conspiracy culture from like, you know, 2008 to 2016 was like, it's going to be a collapse. There'll be economic collapse. It's going to be like Mad Max. You got to stock up on food and guns and ammo and water. And there probably is a good idea behind that. But, you know, like I think we are entering more and more into the brave new world scenario. I mean, even like I don't know if you guys have gotten the temperature checks. They have a gun. I think Andy Nowicki and Tim on your show had pointed that out. It's like a gun to your head.
Yeah.
And I think there's some sci-fi movie where you get like a UBC code or something like that on your forehead and they scan it. And so, I mean, I think definitely like it's like allowing the
ID 2020. That's Bill Gates's tattoo, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to get that and you go in there and it's going to be the cool thing. And, you know, everyone just sort of conforms. So it allows the state access to your body, to your personality. It's extremely dehumanizing. And, I think like, especially countries like America and Italy, I'm not like, I don't think like Salvini or Trump are these great saviors of our people or the Italian people or of our civilization. But I think that some of these things are kind of a punishment, especially in these countries like the United States and Italy, where it's like, you know, we voted for a populist candidate. We voted for what the left side of the deep state didn't want. So, you know, we're going to be punished a little bit and kind of put in line by having all this like lockdown and all this mass hysteria. Whereas other countries that Theo mentioned that are already further along the Agenda 2030 program, maybe they get their reward by not as much hysteria.
Yeah. And again, it all goes back to reality. Is look around you. Do you know anyone who's sick, who's dying? Let's ask yourself that question. You know, what there's no there. So why tolerate any of this stuff? You know, why tolerate the lockdown, shutting down businesses? You know, and again, because they're just telling you something's bad out there, but there's nothing really out there other than regular life. And at the same time, they're proffering advice, which is completely counter to good, you know, health. Stay inside. Don't get sunlight. Don't exercise. You know, the churches are closed, the gyms are closed, but the abortion clinic is open, the liquor store is open, where you can buy lottery tickets and buy alcohol. You know, you know, it's something else that people just accept this. And the problem is this, it gives the lie or it exposes the true nature of the system, because if we did live in a society that was free and you had mediating institutions, checks and balances, like a skeptical media, you know, that wasn't centrally controlled. You know, you had legislative bodies, which were jealous of their powers, that actually checked the executive branches. You know, when these governors declare these states of emergencies with no justification, in essence, to
Let's see, Tim. I think Tim's just been cut out there. Jesse, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I got cut out a little bit earlier too, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, we'll just see if Tim is able to jump back in. I was going to pass on to social engineering and some of the very open ways that governments have looked to psychologically engineer their populations during this crisis. We have something here in the UK called the Government Behavioural Science Unit, and they're very open about using this thing, nudge theory, and it's really just repackaged social engineering. It's just changing the language, but the techniques are the same, and they're very open about it. In a paper submitted to the government's scientific advisory committee in March, they said, a substantial number of people still do not feel sufficiently personally threatened. It could be that they are reassured by the low death rate in their demographic group, although levels of concern may be rising. Having a good understanding of the risk has been found to be positively associated with adoption of COVID-19 social distancing measures in Hong Kong. The perceived level of personal threat needs to be increased among those who are complacent, using hard-hitting emotional messaging. To be effective, this must also empower people by making clear actions they can take to reduce the threat. So I don't know if you'd like to just elaborate on anything to do there with social engineering from your perspective.
Well, a couple of things. One is, you know, I'm kind of a pedestrian train type of guy. I know that's kind of a 2010 tier young fogey post, but in America, you know, I mean, as part of this 2030 agenda is to reduce fossil fuels, and there's definitely been a lot less driving going on. And in America, the car is a profound symbol of our freedom, and we love to get in our cars and drive around everywhere, but that has been curtailed. Also, there's been a radical increase in divorce in the United States during the corona lockdown.
Yeah.
Is that it must have some like anti-fertility effect where you even, I don't want to mention it. I mean, I guess the Catholic podcast, but just I was looking through some of the they have an IMDb, the Parents Guide. And since I'm a scrupulous tradcath, I always try to see, you know, okay, can I watch this movie if it's, you know, got impure scenes or whatever. But there's definitely an encouragement in a lot of these movies of self-abuse, which is a euphemism for those who are not Catholic or watching this for autoeroticism. And this idea
that
there was even articles, like I think in the New York Times, about having sex over Zoom or something like that. And this idea of, like, you know, the reducing population and destroying the intimacy people have. Obviously, you know, I'm a Catholic. This is Catholic Not Podcast. I'm not encouraging people to go out and fornicate or something. But, you know,
courtship between yeah. young men and women so they can get married and have families. That's...
Well, how do you court when you're social distancing?
If
you go out, I mean, if you can't go out anywhere. I mean, you can't even have a church social like the old days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, something more wholesome than in, you know, a singles bar. You know, it's, you know.
No. Yeah, Tim, sorry, we lost you for a little bit. But
as
you can tell, we've moved on to some of the agendas that are taking advantage of this crisis. So it'd be great to get your thoughts on that. Perhaps we could look at what Jim Cramer on CNBC called the greatest wealth transfers in history, the absolute murdering of small businesses that's going on as a result of social distancing and lockdown.
Yeah, you have this great transfer of wealth upward. Surprise, surprise. So you have an economic lockdown that's created by the oligarchs so they can get richer. You know, I think it was Amazon made $58 billion. And this is at the expense of brick and mortar small businesses because all those are being shut down. Restaurants, of course, there's a niche with small non-chain restaurants, which people like, of course. But the only ones left standing are the chain restaurants and the fast food.
And the stock market is booming.
The stock market is booming.
Because there's so much fake money in the system.
$6 trillion is given to them. But, you know, what about the small businesses that actually employ so many Americans, actually provide opportunity, upward mobility and security, and most importantly, independence? That's another thing is the destroying small businesses is the way to further extend corporate control, because much of the control systems that we see are being implemented not legislatively, but through corporations, through, human resource policies, and much of the global homo crap we're subjected to is through private corporations. These are public-private partnerships, if you will. But much of the agenda of LGBTQ and global homo and sort of the culture of death in general is being spearheaded by these corporations. I just found out that the NFL tomorrow is going to celebrate Coming Out Day. What that has to do with football, I don't know, but there we are. You know,
Coming out to vote day.
That's part of the agenda is to destroy the small businesses. And that's all, that factors in the Great Reset, because there's really no room for the middle class with the Great Reset. It's a neo-feudal order without the bomb of Christianity, of course. And so we wonder why. Yeah, all these small businesses, which is the backbone of the middle class, the tradesmen, these things, the working class, and that's being destroyed. At the same time, you look at like the hospitality industry, even to Las Vegas, and that's being destroyed, and the tourist industry. A lot of that was these are industries that are designed to get money from the middle class, to separate the middle class from their money. But with the middle class being phased out, these things are no longer of any use by the oligarchs. So that they're being phased out as well. The destruction of the airline industry, because you're not going to have a routine air travel anymore. This was something revolutionized, culture in the latter half of the second half of the 20th century was air travel.
Don't you think, though, population mobility would be a key component of a globalized system? I'm surprised that they're allowing airlines to be so damaged by this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the assets are going to exist and they'll be bought up for a song. A lot of this, Catherine Austin Fitz, who said that what we're seeing is sort of a leveraged buyout of America. And so you plummet the value of everything and you buy it up for a song. And, what's happening to New York, and people say, New York will never recover. What do they think they're doing up there? Well, they may not want it to recover, because what they want to emerge from the ashes is a sort of a smart grid city, which is going to have another, another purpose. And we see with Agenda 21 and biodiversity rewilding project, the moving people out of rural or semi-rural areas in the mega cities, the subsidization of stack housing, and the ever increasing cost of building single family homes, because this is something, according to the Green Agenda, and Murray Strong said this years ago. He said that the middle class lifestyle of eating meat, enjoying air conditioning in the summertime, and having a single family home is simply not sustainable. And so they have to go away, and this is how they're doing it. And they weren't getting it with the environmental propaganda, that people weren't buying it. They had, who's that girl? Thunberg out of Sweden?
Greta Thunberg,
It would be Joan of Arc of the environmental movement.
Carl Fink, yeah.
Yes, that kind of failed. They got it with this COVID thing, and with the COVID panic is you get something that's very visceral. It's very direct. It's you're going to die. Your grandmother's going to die. And so you have all this heated rhetoric and warning about this dreaded disease. And this is why, remember, it's supposed to be a 2-week lockdown. Curve.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the new normal became the objective, which is a phrase out of Agenda 21, the new normal.
And yeah. We're not build back better.
Build back better, yes.
That's the kind of, my friend calls it the prancha that they're putting out there. It's a Portuguese word. It means plank. It's when the the oligarchs, the New World Order, the plutocrats have a, they get a message and then they meme that message out into the general consciousness, called a prancha. It's quite a useful word.
Yeah.
Scripture says that the debtor is under the power of the creditor, and that the human history bears out the truth of that statement. And what we're seeing here is a huge rise in government and indebtedness, absent wartime. And what is so depressing is to see how, I mean, in this country, we have a much larger welfare state proportionally than you do in America. And so the government implemented a furlough scheme, basically paying the wages of inactive workers because of the shutdown. And this government largesse has the effect of kind of morphing. It's both numbing and it's addictive. A huge number of people in this country are kind of living in this fantasy land where they're divorced from reality and they don't quite know the pain that's coming around the corner and the indebtedness that the country is going to be in for many decades, providing things kind of continue on the same sort of trajectory. But it also plays into the fact that this is something Neil Ferguson, the neocon historian, got in trouble about when he was talking about John Maynard Keynes. And he said, you know, this piling up of debts bespeaks a kind of homosexual view of the future, which is basically anti-natal. It doesn't have a view of burdening future generations of one's children and grandchildren with the indulgences of this generation, of basically cashing the tax receipts of future generations to pay for your so-called crisis management. Well, if you have a situation today where people don't have children, where they're atomized, where the family's broken down, then they take on this debt and they genuinely think that it's sustainable.
Yeah, it's the gay disco E. Michael Jones talks about. The homosexuality of John Maynard Keynes factored into his view, because when confronted with the contradiction of his economic viewpoint, he said, well, in the end, we're all dead, right?
Mm.
So it's a fatalistic view. And those sort of an indifference or contempt for posterity. And that's something you get with a homosexual, because that's why they call it a culture of death. They don't worry about their kids or their grandkids. And this is sort of the ethic or the approach that democracy produces, because the politicians themselves don't consider, they're just placeholders, or they're part, you know, they're there for the short term, get reelected, get rich and get out. So they have a very short term view of things. Whereas, particularly maybe a monarch might have a long term effect, a long term view of things, might have a long term view of things. There's a chance of getting a good king. Much better chance of getting a good king than there is of getting a good president. This sort of disregard for any notion of fiscal sanity that you got with this crisis is just right now, President Trump, and they're talking about a new relief bill, $1.8 trillion, $2 trillion. Hey, why not? I mean, you can create money out of thin air. Why not? Mm. But it ignores the reality is ultimately an economy has to produce something, goods and services, things of, you know, of value and wealth. And if people aren't working, you're pretending to pay them. And at least in the Soviet Union, people pretended to work and they got paid. Now they're being people told, no, don't work, stay at home. It's unsustainable. And that might be something to do with it, again, creating conditions for an economic collapse or collapse of the currency. This whole thing, I think, started in the fall. Of course, that was also coincided with the collapse of the repo market. And so they needed a bailout, a short-term bailout. And they couldn't do that, an over $6 trillion bailout of the market, without perhaps creating some sort of strain or run on the dollar. So you create a COVID panic, or a pandemic, rather. And they're doing it. It's a response to the pandemic, not the response to to the collapse of an over-indebted economic system that they've been patching together since 2008. And so it was a short-term attempt to save the dollar. But ultimately, I think what they're doing is this is a process of actually destroying the currency, all currencies, because on the other side of the collapse, you have the Great Reset, which I think envisions sort of a social credit system, and a UBI system, which people are getting used to, acclimatized to, with this furlough program, where I don't really have to work. I just get a check dumped in my account every month, and isn't this great? Or I get used to it. And of course, the problem with that is, with that, you have no independence. Even today, even with a debauched currency, if you have money, they have to maintain some value of it for it to act as a currency. So in the meantime, if you possess that currency, you have some degree of independence. And perhaps even anonymity if you use cash. This is why there's a war on cash. Remember when they started talking about COVID and cash, money, spreading it, as if everything else doesn't spread it too? But no, for some reason money's a particular threat. You know, why not doorknobs, you know? And everything.
Yeah, it's outrageous. For the last month, I've basically been denied a lot of mainstream chains and smaller businesses from paying for goods with cash.
Yes.
Which is, it's legal tender. And this has happened completely covertly without a peep or without any kind of debate or anything. But it's just under the emergency powers of COVID, I suppose. Just to say that, it is interesting to kind of do a survey of the world and see that if you actually look into each country's political establishment, there are particular reasons in most of them for continuing the hysteria. So you can see that in China, you had the Hong Kong protests and then even anti-pollution protests in Wuhan. Although COVID seems to have cleared up very quickly there, which you would expect from a virus, actually, that it just comes through. It does its damage. It kills the kind of, the vulnerable, the low hanging fruit, so to speak, and then, moves on. You know, that's it. And then in France, the Yellow Vest movement has been dispersed. Very interesting analysis about Italy and the Prime Minister Conte, where 15 out of 20 Italian regions are held by his political rival. And he has no electoral mandate, having stolen government power in a sort of parliamentary coup, sort of stitch up. And it's clear that an outdoor mask mandate is a signal of political solidarity with his Partito Democratico authoritarian swing, a sign of who's boss, as a kind of warning to the regions that no options to implement lighter COVID restrictions would be allowed. He's in a difficult position now that the Italian public is waking up to the realization that they've been had, that their elderly relatives up north died because the government ordered sick people transferred into nursing homes, that their businesses and livelihoods have been destroyed for lockdowns that could have been avoided, and that under Renzi, his predecessor, his party sold controlling interests in key Italian industries, utilities, and banks to the Chinese Communist Party, using national pension funds to pay for 1 million-plus migrants to be brought in, et cetera, et cetera. All under a mandate obtained by maneuvering for a government they didn't earn and now couldn't earn an election. So they have to maintain this illusion of a national health emergency because they know, as well as anyone else, that the minute normality is restored, their electoral guillotine awaits. So you see this in kind of many, many countries.
If I can just throw another kind of left field comment here, I think there definitely is an element of sadism to this too. Like, this is an idea, and you look at these characters, Gavin Newsom, and I can't judge his heart, but there seems to be this desire to sort of say, we live in a different world than you. And I'll give you an example. I'm a marathon runner, and most marathons this year have been closed down. And I remember I was at a hotel, and I was running on a treadmill. And they had this kind of, this was before COVID, this interactive, like, you could pretend to be running in this beautiful rainforest in New Zealand, or you could pretend to be running in Utah. And then I remember looking at Richard Branson's LinkedIn, and he's the head of Virgin Corp, is one of your compatriots, Theo. And he had just done some sort of like fantastic run in, I don't know, South America of some kind. So there's definitely this idea of like a two-tiered society, this idea that, you know, we are the cows. And this is very much tied to this whole sort of I can only describe as kind of Luciferian social Darwinism, this idea that like we didn't make it. We didn't win. We weren't smart enough to like get to be Bill Gates. And we didn't go to Yale or whatever, or Eaton, I guess, Theo. I think that
it's Nietzsche's philosophy. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, Nietzsche's philosophy, I think there's a lot of wisdom in Nietzsche. I can say that as a Catholic, but it definitely is satanic ultimately. Like the Übermensch, this idea of going beyond good and evil, is definitely evil. And these people, I think, at least some of them believe this about themselves. They get to have guns. We don't. They get to eat steaks. Like George Soros can go have his steak and with his son or something. And then like I have to eat like a Beyond Burger from Hardee's.
Yeah. Or bugs.
Yeah. You can eat bugs.
Bugs. Just a side note, you mentioned Richard Branson. I think he got a start with, what was it, Virgin Records?
Yes.
And Virgin Records' first mega hit was Tubular Bells, which was the theme song to The Exorcist. So.
Oh, my goodness. That creeps me out. Okay. Oh, man. Okay.
Come full circle there.
Well, you know, in The Exorcist, too, the original Exorcist, the priest cannot exorcise the demon. So, you know, that rarely happens. I don't think that ever happens. I think eventually if you follow the rite and the person being possessed, you know, is complicit to a certain degree. I don't want to step outside my bounds of what I know. But, like, the priest will drive the demon out. But at the end of the movie,
he has the power of Christ.
Yeah, and in the movie, he has to make a deal. And then all of a sudden you have all these serial killers and horror films, this idea that there's a scene in one of the Nightmare on Elm Streets I think it's originally in the play Agamemnon by Aeschylus, where Orestes is crawling before the statue of Apollo and the Furies are dancing around him. But in the Nightmare on Elm Street, this girl, I think, is praying to Our Father and grasping hold of this stone cross of some kind. And Kreddy's mocking her there. So I think that Lovecraftian idea, which is behind coronavirus as well, that we cannot defeat this thing. The only thing that can beat it is the state. And there are these evils out there who are out to get us. I think that's very much behind the whole coronavirus meme.
And of course, the abandonment by the Catholic Church of the faithful
my goodness,
I think it's an act of apostasy. But it's again, it shows the cowardly response. And the fact is, you know, just a lack of sophistication, if anything, understanding, you know, the powers that be, and you know. Might the cardinals not take politicians' claims at face value and tell them to shut the churches down? I mean, you think a little skepticism there? We don't need Easter Mass. That's too dangerous. And I had my church effectively shut down, and then had all the social distancing rules, so I stopped attending Mass there. I had to find another church that was more hospitable. But that you're destroying the parish when you do that, and the church is cutting its own throat because the church is supposed to function on the parish system where you support your parish and the community. Cool. And the church has been, you know, the past 60 years have done so much to destroy that level of support in society. You know, under the guise of integration, now it's public health. You know, they might as well take the crucifix down and put up the COVID ball, because that's what they're worshiping.
Yeah. Well, and the theology's collapsed.
Yeah.
They, in a sense, these prelates have been denying the importance of the sacraments ever since the Second Vatican Council. Dr. John Rao said that he awoke in the middle of the night and suddenly just realized, in the midst of all this, the Catholic Church has announced to the entire world the sacraments are a non-essential service.
Yes, yeah.
That's what it comes down to, and it's a horrendous denial of the church's universal mission to mediate salvation, and it's a persecution of the church that's happening now, but it's happening from the Judases within, and I think there's so much to say, but on visiting a church, for me, the perfect kind of inverted symbol of the triumph of the natural over the supernatural is how the holy water stoops have been replaced by alcohol gel dispensers. It encapsulates this in this diabolical inversion. And are they saying that God is going to use holy water to pass disease to faithful followers of his son who remind themselves of his covenant? Or even the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ himself. The number of bishops that have actually denied or suppressed Holy Communion on the tongue, which is canonically illegal and grounds for immediate removal, actually by the laity, is huge. The tape that festoons the inside of the churches, which all says one thing. It says, be afraid of death. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that our, you know, what our Lord taught us is to not be afraid of death, to have faith in the eternal life that, that awaits us.
And what bothers me is this is something that's non-existent, it's trivial. This is how you respond to something that's something so, I mean, something so trivial from a, I mean, just from empirical. Empirically, you can look at it and go, well, there's nothing really dangerous here. So why the panicky response, you know?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that there are, no, I'm sorry, Tim, keep going.
No, go ahead. I just, there's no pandemic.
Yeah, it's a big line.
In several Catholic prophecies, there's this mention of the Mass being hidden or shut down or only said in secret. And people before the COVID, they had no idea like what that could possibly entail, like all around the world. But that literally happened. And yeah, I mean, there have been times in the past where, you know, churches or dioceses have shut down because of a real plague. And so people were like puking blood up in the streets or whatever. And there was a need to shut it down. I mean, there definitely is a great deal of crossover between, you know, the left wing of the deep state and the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. There's no question. Even the kind of normie media is picking that on that up. I had some interesting articles I'd written about McCarrick, Cardinal McCarrick, working with the Obama State Department and the crossover with Georgetown University. And I will say, too, that in the same sense, there is a crossover with kind of the trad media and the right wing of the deep state, especially kind of the Anglo-American and then Israeli alliance as well. Like there's no question. I mean, in the past it was the neocons, and then there was this kind of lull and confusion. And then now there's definitely, I mean, there seems to be in my mind money being poured through certain media outlets, secular media outlets into the Catholic media. But I mean, I guess the overall point is that, you know, if there really was a, you know, serious pandemic, then there have been times in the past where certain areas have closed their churches. But the fact that this doesn't seem to be, as far as I can tell, as serious as people are suggesting means there could be something else going on here.
Well, you know, they say, would they ever dare to shut down the churches? Well, they did. With the complicity of the bishops, they shut the churches down. They couldn't go to Easter Mass, and now they've created, you know, capacity restrictions that would destroy not only it destroys the solemnity of the Mass, it prevents the church from functioning, performing its social functions, which is a big part, creating a community that has some strength and, you know, and vitality. And it just further alienates and atomizes society. I mean, what church wasn't strong going into this thing? Again, to have the bishops fold as easily as they did, and at least they could have done is put up a fight and a confrontation, because the politicians would have blinked if they had said, no, we're not doing it, at least early on, you know. But it's amazing to me just how people respond to the immediate propaganda, the immediate news reports. The early days of this thing, people were so panicky, and I immediately started asking. Well, I was familiar with the swine flu scandal, the problem with the HIV/AIDS hypothesis and the scandal with Dr. Fauci and all that. So immediately when I saw his face, I was skeptical. I didn't give him any credibility. For a while, he's a person that couldn't be questioned. But I was familiar with the research, people like John Rappaport and their research about the medical industrial complex and its corruption. But this what it just shows is sort of the century of propaganda regarding, you know, the germ theory, the medical industrial complex, and the idea of the heroic physician saving us, you know, from nature, has set us up for this, because there's so much credibility being poured into these institutions. When if you just do a cursory investigation into the various scandals, you shouldn't have any trust in these institutions, which I didn't going into it. So I was immediately skeptical when I heard about the reports of a virulent disease or virus that was going to, you know, wipe out, you know, a quarter of humanity. You know, but again, people watch movies like Contagion, or, you know, they they're familiar with The Stand, Stephen King's book in the miniseries. And just lo and behold, Chris, there's a remake of The Stand coming out now, right? This fall. That again, this idea that this pandemic, that's going to wipe out humanity, and this has its effect, because most people get their idea of reality, unfortunately, from entertainment or from fake news. So they're easily set up for this.
Yeah, it's interesting too that there's this constant propaganda about China, you know, at this time, China, China, China. Don't you hate China? Like, especially on kind of the neocon or post-neocon sort of neo-populist.
Yeah.
Right. And there has been some interesting commentary about China and the New Silk Road that I think it runs it goes into the Mediterranean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think through Israel. And there, I don't know why there would be this pressure right now, don't you dislike China? You know, I thought for a second maybe they're going to try some sort of war scenario. I guess not. But Tim, I know Theo, this is your show, but I'm going to field this question to Tim real quickly. Like, Tim, have you any thoughts on that? Like, why is there this like propaganda? Like, China's bad. China is the one who gave us. It's the China virus.
Yeah, the Wuhan virus, Wuhan flu. China, even Donald Trump says China did this. He's saying, yeah. And it's because I think it goes to this relationship that China has with the West since the 1990s, where it was set up to be this industrial, production site, and this coincided with the deindustrialization of the West, which was decided in the 1970s, and so the World Economic Forum, the Davos set, so they're engaged in sort of reorganizing the geographics of production. And, this is a plan that was, I think, staked out in the early 70s with the Trilateral Commission. And so China became this huge powerhouse economically, producing things, because state capitalism, sort of a Rockefeller fantasy, how their society should be governed. They don't have any it's a very easily managed society because they're very compliant. It's the Asian culture. So people like the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and bankers like that. But at the same time, the Chinese Communist Party, I think, for better or worse, represents, Chinese identity, and they see themselves not completely within the Western bank financial control system.
They're partnered with that. Them.
So there's probably tension within the Chinese government about how they should approach the West. The same thing is probably occurring in Russia too. But if you look at this goes back to the Mackinder Doctrine, the Anglo-American, and then ultimately the Zaire Doctrine of the sea powers having control or a measure of leverage over the continental powers. This is very important because that doctrine created two world wars in the last century to control Germany. And get Germany under their control, and also to weaken Russia. The whole idea was to get Germany and Russia to fight. And I think even when NATO was set up, it was to keep Germany down, the Russians out. Because if they ever worked together, that'd be a problem for the Anglo-Zaire-American system. And so this idea of China getting together, with Russia, and then Europe. Well, that's this Eurasian condominium being set up that would just weaken the control of the Anglo-American Zaire Empire. So that's why you see this tension going on. And at the same time, China is a partner in this stuff. I think China, in its own way, helped create the pandemic scamdemic by announcing this outbreak. It solved, as you alluded to, it solved their immediate political problems because it stopped the protests in Hong Kong and the protests in Wuhan over the air pollution. And also it creates them as the ideal, as how the world should be run with the social credit system. And I think, Whitney Webb, the journalist at the Last American Vagabond, she did a number of stories about this, how, maybe it was the 2014-2015 Defense Authorization Act created this outfit called the National Artificial Intelligence Security Commission. It's an obscure organization, and they produced a report which called for the United States to bypass China on artificial intelligence in order to facilitate the development of, what they call the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So this coincides with what they're thinking of over there at Davos. But what it called for was the doing away of legacy systems. And what they consider legacy systems are privately owned automobiles, brick-and-mortar stores, retail stores, everything online, cash. So it's that China model. So in order to beat China, we have to become China. That was sort of the attitude of this commission. But this, but lo and behold, you know, everything they're calling for is gradually implemented with the response to the coronavirus, because you have online shopping, the destruction of brick-and-mortar small businesses. People aren't driving anywhere. People aren't driving anywhere. Roads aren't going to be maintained anymore. What's the purpose of the infrastructure in these things? So these things can be slowly eroded over the course of several decades as people become alienated from them. I mean, I read a report, a story the other day talking about how today's teenagers aren't anxious to learn how to drive because they're at home all day. Think about that. You know? And they have no real ambition to go out and be independent because they're online all day. And I struggle with this with my own kids. It's forming their attitude. They become very insular. You know, they become very, very solipsistic and very inward looking because they're in their own little world. And the technology is all driving them to this. And of course, at the same time, the outside world is locked down. So there's nothing really pulling out, you know. Out in that world, classes are shut down. University systems, everyone's online at universities, so they're paying the full weight of full fare, but they're not going to classes. You know, so it's kind of, all these things kind of converge, you know, to create this world that you know that they envision at the World Economic Forum. Everyone kind of online, locked into their own little. You know, cubicles at home, their stack house apartments, not out doing things, not out, you know, getting fresh air, exerting themselves physically. So, you know.
You know what's interesting? There was this book. It was really atrocious, but I read it, and then it was made into a movie, Ready Player One. And it was about people living in these trailers stacked one after each other, like literally like trailers, like from a trailer park. Mm-hmm. And the boy would go out and live in this fantasy world of playing video games. And it was basically like this, the new merger, or it was basically like being on Disney Plus, or like an MMO, like, I forget what that's an acronym for, but so like you'd go out into this fantasy world and play and how wonderful it was and whatever. So that was rolled out, you know, a few years ago before the pandemic, but I think this is something they've been pushing for a long time. Is that we go to work, we get in the morning, we get on a bus, a self-driving bus of some kind, and then we go to work at like Soros Widgets or something, and then we come home and take drugs, and then like we watch Disney Plus for 4 hours and go to bed. And then meanwhile, Richard Branson is like hiking through the Himalayas or whatever.
Just to return to your point, Dr. Russell, on China, I've certainly picked up on the China baiting, particularly from the right wing of the deep state. I think that the Chinese certainly, or at least their state media, claimed that the Hong Kong protests were a CIA-backed color revolution. And I'm sure, you know, that deserves investigation. And there's probably something to that, part of the sort of strategy of tension. I think that you could posit that they are looking to stoke tension. So there is a third world war, and then that crisis leads to a new world order. If you think of the Freemasonic motto, solve et coagula. But then, as you alluded to, Tim, there is also a kind of, there's a enamored feeling towards China as well. So, I think there's sort of multiple strands going on here. But just to move on to looking at the media have played such a part in all of this. No scrutiny, no questioning, just spreading the fear. And causing division amongst the population, that the vile media bears such huge responsibility, not only for the current hysteria, but for inculcating this belief that science has pretty much conquered death. And I think there's a bigger issue here, a bigger spiritual issue, which is, you know, secular societies have excluded discussions of philosophy, religion, or meaning at all from the public square. And modern man is terrified of death because he lives in a state of practical atheism. Death, as we know, is the condition of life. But generally speaking, we've become so insulated from the reality of the event horizon of death. In the modern world, we sort of curtain away death. It happens in old people's homes, in hospitals. This was never the case for the majority of human history. It happened, you know, perhaps your grandparent or something would die in your family home. So this terror of death, and I think the subconscious terror of judgment, because most people live in a state of mortal sin, is what drives this willingness to take this, you know, fairly innocuous virus for most people, for them to take it so seriously. And then just to return to the media, as I mentioned earlier, that you have seen some sort of right-wing commentators like Douglas Murray directing attention to Black Lives Matter and the Antifa, which is, of course, a serious issue, but rather than the ongoing decimation of small businesses, for example. I think they're kind of safety valve figures, and they spin the kind of bungling government narrative, whereby it's the decimation we're seeing, the destruction, the deterioration of Western civilization is as a result of government incompetence rather than a more malevolent agenda.
Yeah, it kind of gives covers up the true agenda by saying this is just a overreaction, bad policy, and if you just elect somebody else, you know, a Biden over Trump, that's what we should do, or you know, have an election replace a Boris Johnson, or get rid of Dan Andrews in Australia, and have him resign or something, and ignores the fact that large body of evidence to show that this thing has been coordinated transnationally, and the governments we think are sovereign are simply vassal states for the oligarchs, and that's something that's it's discomforting, because it's all of a sudden realize that, you know, we can't vote our ways out of this. We can't, you know, appeal to our governments and talk reason with these people, because they're following orders from a malevolent elite, and you're going to have to organize and strategize differently to overcome it. And simply acts of, you know, civil disobedience and noncompliance, and ultimately holding the traitors accountable. You know, sic semper tyrannis. And that's something that, I don't know if people have the agency to do that at this point, or the clarity,
or the virtue,
the virtue, because what they're planning is so demonic and evil that there has to be some sort of consequences for the betrayal that they've been a part of. You know, it's not just throwing them out of office. When I see, you know, when you look at someone like a Cuomo or a Newsom or Whitmore, you know, They can't be allowed to get away with this. At the same time, they're not at the top of the pyramid here. They're simply following orders at this point. And this is why, you know, if we did have a sovereign government, you'd have congressional inquiries, investigations, grand juries called, the foundations, the Open Society Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations, they would be subpoenaed, investigated, and have their assets seized, because this – there are all laws in the books that deal with this. There are, you know, RICO laws and conspiracy laws that if the government had any measure of independence, would be investigating, because they're involved in a revolution, and they're involved in subverting society, undermining society, creating chaos that's going to result in the death of tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, if their vision is fulfilled.
Yeah, there was a very good video E. Michael Jones did about the Black Lives Matter rioting and Antifa rioting. that this is in preparation to get the Black community distracted about the supposed impending annexation of the West Bank. And I think that, you know, I think that the coronavirus thing and the lockdown is its own thing, right? I think it's being done for its own sake. But I think that there are other things going on now that people are being distracted from. And one of them, obviously, they're going to do something about the election. I think they want to make darn sure, even though, you know, Trump is not our guy or whatever, nonetheless, they want to make sure he's not in there. And they want to put in Biden and, you know, Kamala Harris, and they'll kind of accelerate things at this point. And so they can do all this, you know, finagling. I don't want to sound like Steve Bannon here or something, but they'll do all this finagling with the mail-in ballots, I'm sure. Yeah. This is a way to get a lot done here in the United States, you know, by having people stay home. And I think there may be something just to the idea of, like, if this is a flu virus of some kind and it takes out an elderly population. I mean, I was looking at states like Florida, where it's like the percentage of immigrants coming in vis-a-vis the percentage of native born Americans who died, you know, of complications due to old age. And, you know, like how that is a shift from Trump to Biden voters most of the time. So I think that this idea of tampering with the election, not saying Trump is this great hope, but tampering with the election is definitely part of this.
Well, yeah, demographic warfare is a form of tampering with elections. You know, if you bring in large bodies of people to more or less gerrymander a country, and that's what they've been doing. The Catholic Church, of course, has been a part of this. They've been paid to be a part of this. I think close to $100 million a year in refugee resettlement. And so this is why some states are now turning purple, if not blue, that were traditionally red. And you can play games, you know, that way. So that's another form of destabilization. Not just the elections, but also how you upset the day-to-day life of a particular community or state. So there's that. But again, that's another thing where some of these organizations should be investigated. I mean, it's not as if people are walking, you know, from Somalia to Minnesota. You know, how are they getting there? And so that's that. But that policy has been in place for years with immigration and refugee resettlement and supposed asylum claims. And you have now you have a situation. Of course, what's going on in Europe, where it's been openly declared by Barbara Leonard Spector, who infamously said that the ethno-European state is a thing of the past. I think Wesley Clark said that, or when he was head of NATO, or General Wesley Clark. So they're playing games with populations, you know, shifting populations around. Look what happened to California, you know, with mass immigration, California, what it turned into. And it's not because the people who lived in California had a change of heart. They've actually changed people. So now you have a different politics there. And that radiates throughout the country because you have the California mafia. You know, Nancy Pelosi is the speaker. And, of course, Kamala Harris is their senator from California. And they reflect the corrupt politics of that state.
You know. Now, regarding the election you're having next month, the general election, I would suspect that the oligarchs don't just have a plan A. They have a plan B, a plan C. I read quite an interesting theory that actually they want you to vote for Trump, because that keeps the frog boiling, more slowly, more effectively. They can keep Trump in the White House kind of tweeting, ineffectively while they continue the cultural degradation, the wealth transfer, et cetera.
Yeah, Trump tweeted why Rome burned, right?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. While funding Planned Parenthood. And appointing court justices who, when push comes to shove, they may just, turn, like Anthony Kennedy or Sandra Day O'Connor. So I think this, and then there's the other theory, which you've raised before, Tim, about how they actually want a very close election, a la 2000 and it's come down to the Supreme Court and then have a split court 4-4 perhaps, and then have the kickoff, the spark that sets alight a civil war. I think there's kind of different strands to, you know, there's different plans that they could follow here. It's quite hard to kind of predict.
Yeah, we've seen how various mayors and governors aren't willing to maintain law and order in their states. And usually there's this liberal states, there's Washington, California, Minnesota, you have situation in Missouri where, there's a Republican governor, but you have local DAs like Kim Gardner who are actually just by not prosecuting cases and also then prosecuting other cases, you can add to the disorder. You have that incident in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where this, I guess, mid-sized town is assaulted by these Antifa protesters. There's an apparent stand down by law enforcement. And any medium sized, average size of the United States, police have the resources to stop these riots, and they're just not wanting to for some reason. And then you have, local DAs who are Soros funded, adding to the disorder by not prosecuting the protesters and going after those who have the audacity to defend their property. So you have that. And you can create the condition. And I think there's, a group that was formed, in the fall of 2019 going into the pandemic, the Transition Integrity Project, which, I think, Rosa Brooks is her name, and she started, and she worked for the Open Society Foundation, and it's a bipartisan group that dealing with that is anticipating much of the controversy following the election, and they've war gamed this scenario too, and they're more or less predicting unrest and controversy, and of course this whole thing with mail-in ballots adds to it because that creates a whole nother level of corruption, potential corruption. And believe me, with balloting, if it's potential corruption, it is going to be corruption. And you don't even have the relative discipline of the voting booth to control it. Now you have people mailing stuff in, and they've already found bundles of ballots trashed or something for voting for Donald Trump. I think it was in Pennsylvania. So you have that controversy. And then you couple that, you have a deadlocked Supreme Court, and you've had the precedent set by months of governors and mayors allowing, riots to occur. So now people know they can get away with it. So you have a very volatile situation. You get a riot. And if you have a riot and then you have shootings, then you might have something where they had in Tunisia or Libya, or Yemen, or even Ukraine, where all of a sudden snipers show up and they start shooting people, and then you can blame the sitting president, and that's how you get a color revolution. And apparently, we've been experiencing a color revolution here because if you look at, the fact that Black Lives Matter and Tifa are all corporately lavished with corporate funds, you have the government officials who aren't maintaining law and order, enforcing law, all tied back to Soros. Then you have that. You can have investigate that because these are foundations that are engaged in subversion. But long ago, back in the 1950s, when we had the Reese Committee hearings on the foundations and their role in subversion, they pretty much came to determination that they were involved in subversion. Back then, it was done in the Cold War context and communism, but they found that they were involved in subverting the American form of government, American way of life as they understood it. But back then, there was a more of an understanding of what subversion meant. Now we're so diverse, people might not understand what subversion is. But the committee itself was shut down by the powers that be because they were investigating. I think in this case it was the Carnegie and Ford Foundation's involvement in these things. But they were indeed involved in subversion, and they have been involved in subversion since then. Promoting the sexual revolution, the cultural revolution, controlling the direction of research and universities and these things that you can install people. A good example is the cultural Marxist who flooded the universities in the 1950s and 60s, the very time when universities were greatly expanding. And so they turned the academia into this arena of radicalism and insanity, and we're seeing the effects of it today.
Yeah, actually I have to bail here in just a second, but I want to kind of shotgun some things at y'all and get some of your responses and kind of respond to some things that Theo put out there. The first is I think ultimately the system is controlled from the very top. I think it's sort of diabolical control, and I think it's possible there are, you know, a few families like that proverbial room in the X-Files. You kick down the door and there's the smoking man in there and all these kind of European and Eurasian, we'll just say, aristocrats in there. But I think the whole Trump phenomenon was something where the Israeli right and then some tech billionaires and then maybe people out of the whole Texas oil milieu, right wing, the CIA kind of broke off from the old neoconservative establishment. That's where you have all these like the Lincoln Project and Bill Kristol and all these guys. I think something definitely happened there. And then the rest of the system began to attack that. So I don't think Trump is sincere, and since he's on the side of our people or of our church, but I do think that the hatred toward him is genuine. I think the Democrats want to win. Mm-hmm. I think that, and this is an apocryphal statement that's been on the internet, but that supposedly Henry Kissinger had called the New York Post and said, this was about, I don't know, 10 years ago, and said, you know, I can't do a Jay Dyer impression of him, so I suck. But he said, you know, in 10 years, the country of Israel will no longer exist. And then he hung up. And Kissinger is supposedly the more left-wing, you know, Eastern establishment, Rockefeller, even though he worked the Nixon administration. So I guess my point would be that in response to one of the things that Theo said, that I don't think that it's all totally controlled. I think Trump is put in by the right wing of the deep state to keep the frog boiling. But I don't think that someone's going to say, well, you know, let's put Trump in instead of Biden. I think that's possible. Definitely that something like that could happen. But I think that there's a genuine antipathy there. I mean, you could see at the very least at the middle level and lower level, there's a genuine hatred among sort of the Hollywood left toward Trump. It's visceral.
Yeah, you saw that with the FBI and their plot against Trump, too.
Yeah.
Sort of beltway set where they just think that, you know, take it for granted that they're morally superior and they have sort of an entitlement to subvert the presidency and concoct this, you know, this Russia collusion scheme, which now it's coming out that there was apparently Hillary Clinton's idea, but no one's really no one's prosecuting her for it, though.
Yeah, it was people from Russia. It wasn't the Russians
okay.
who supported Trump.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't think you look at it as being something as complex can be controlled, and ultimately humanity can't be controlled, but they can sure create a lot of pain and problems trying to control it. But yeah, the situations are dynamic, so it's hard to, you know. That's why you can't predict how it's going to turn out. Too many variables. And there's, of course, then there's always, you know, there's always the cunning of reason. You know, there's always, God.
Yeah.
You know, and ultimately they, you know, they can't subvert the will of God. And, some of these things might be working, to see the fulfillment of his plan, which ultimately it is. And that's why I look back this whole thing with the whole COVID thing. As distressing and as agonizing as it may be, as it may cause anxiety and fear, it ultimately is a gift because prior to it, people weren't going to be stirred or awakened by it. But I think this thing has awakened and aroused a lot of people to say, "Huh, what's going on? Wait a second, there's something to this because it's so obvious." You know, when Bill Gates is out there on CNN saying, yeah, we're going to give you this tattoo. It's going to monitor you and vaccines are going to be, you know, compulsory and life won't go back to normal ever. You know, it's hard to deny that something's going on.
Yeah, but it's obvious to you, Tim, but, I have been, surprised, but then less surprised about the docility of the population in the face of all this evidence. I ask myself, how can so many of the members of the public put up with such a flagrant lie that we live in?
Yeah.
And I answer myself, people are happy to live in a lie. To be a faithful Catholic is to live amidst the lies of the world. The lie that man has no religious instinct. The lie that the natural law isn't inscribed on every man's heart. The lie that life doesn't begin at conception. The lie that two men committing sodomy in a men's room is equal to your grandparents who loved each other, got married and had a family. The lie that there is no difference between men and women. The lie that a man can mutilate himself and become a woman. Lies, lies, lies. Modernity is lies and unreality. Yes, this one is very overt and in your face, but if most people already live in mortal sin, then their intellects are darkened. And so the human material itself is of a lower quality, as a result of centuries of moral degradation since the dissolution of Christendom. And modernity is the denial of sacrifice. People will not pay the price of resisting this hideous strength.
Yeah, you think
yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, ahead, you don't want to. I mean, stand up for my Christian faith. I don't want to be a martyr, do I?
Well, actually, that's an elevator straight to heaven. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the people's attitude. That's like you don't want to. You want your bishop to stand up to the state because you know they might lose their tax exemption or something. That's a.
Wait, Theo, this will probably be the last thing I say or question I throw out there before I go. But, you know, there in a lot of traditional Catholic media, there's been a lot of discussion. You mentioned, you know, abortion about the pro-life movement being co-opted. Now, there is an argument for another time, and I think I've mentioned it before on somebody's show. I forget what that the pro-life movement was co-opted in the 80s or late 70s to make it less Christian and less Catholic. And kind of water it down and make it, well, you know, we're going to make the arguments about the person. We're not going to, like, push this as a religious issue.
Not talk about contraception, not talk about modesty, not talk about chastity. Yeah.
And then that more recently, there's been kind of this waffling in the pro-life movement where it's like, well, you know, we want to have a big tent pro-life movement. So we can't, you know, like, supposedly, and, you know, I've just been glancing at these articles, that there's this openness now to, like, well, in certain circumstances, we would push for partial or allow for partial legalization of abortion. Now, contrary to that, in the New York Times, there's been articles like panicking, like we need to get ready because Trump is going to overthrow Roe versus Wade if he puts in Amy Coney Barrett. And I think she's kind of an interesting character herself. But I guess I'll throw this out there as a question. I mean, if the deep state were to allow Roe versus Wade to be overturned, why would that be? I mean, is that just sort of a bone to Christians? Is it this idea that, well, we already contracept and we're, you know, having dates on Zoom now, so we don't have to worry about fertility anymore?
Yeah.
I don't think they would allow it to be overturned. It's so powerfully symbolic. And the demons do not throw bones. I was reading the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, and he mentions there that one of the Screwtape the older demon, the more senior demon, is writing, and he says that look, we don't care how these humans are damned as long as they're damned. That I think there's truth to that, but also the demons want more depravity. They don't just, you know, they'd rather you go to hell for blasphemy and say masturbation than for fornication. They want you lower in hell than as low as possible. So I think the kind of pressure that the Supreme Court justice would come under from all quarters if it was ever raised for the possibility of Roe being struck down, I can see it not happening, or, you know, they're them resisting.
Well, they've got their man Roberts there whenever there has been a critical vote. John, you know, it's funny, I saw him one time at the National Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C., but he voted in Oberfell. He voted how did he vote there? Tim, do you know that in Oberfell versus Hodges, did he vote in favor of gay marriage or against it?
No, I don't think he did. I think Kennedy had a swing vote. No,
I think Kennedy, yeah.
It was in the transgender one.
Yeah, him and Gorsuch, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Where they're expanding or extending, I guess, federal protection to transgendered people.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yes, I think these figures are to perpetuate people's faith in the democratic system that, hey, if we just get one more judge on the bench, we can overturn it. So people stay invested in the whole dialectic, mm-hmm. You know, rather than examining the actual question of the American proposition and the fact that the First Amendment is an offense to God.
Well, I think. I'm sorry. Keep going.
No. That was what I was going to say.
Yeah, I'm gonna say this very carefully. I mean, I've prayed out abortion clinics and held up signs in several different states and several different countries, actually. But I think that is used as a distraction for us. I'm not telling people not to do that. I'm saying go ahead and do that. I think it's a powerful witness. But they allow that. So they allow the March for Life. You know what I'm saying? So it's like you guys can get out and march, and I think people should go. I've been to the March for Life several times myself. But that's allowable. That's a steam valve. Now, if we were to say, you know what, we're going to like seize the Supreme Court building. Now, don't go do this, anyone. But or we're going to push very hard. We're going to organize. We're going to get money together. And we're going to get a senator who's going to do this for Catholics or Christians or, you know, our people, broadly speaking. That would definitely they'd come down on that like a ton of bricks. So I think that the pro-life movement is kind of massaged. In a certain sense, it's very good to pray outside of abortion clinics and hold signs. It's very good. I've done it many times, but that is allowable because it doesn't threaten the center of power. You know, eventually they would like to get rid of that, and they do, and they send cops out or rent a cops to bully people, and they have these Karens come out and attack pro-lifers out there. But I think that is allowed or has been allowed for a while.
Yeah, abortion is an important right in the Masonic Judeo-Masonic world order.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
no
it's
question.
A right, and it's interesting because I read an article talking about Amy Coney Barrett and her Catholicism, how it does. It was a piece in the New York Times, and said that she. Isn't consistent, isn't truly in line with the American ethos. And I found myself agreeing with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as a Catholic, you have to have something incompatible with Orthodox or traditional Catholicism and with the American system. And that's something that, you know, it's hard to swallow for a lot of people because they think, you know, loyal Americans, but there's sort of, I think, abortion itself is the reductio ad absurdum of quarter of the American experiment, if you will. So is homosexuality and, you know, these other things.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like there was a war fought initially by like Puritans and Protestants, and then later on by Catholics and Protestants, you know, against this Masonic system, but it ultimately won. You know,
yeah, this
it ultimately conquered us and defeated the Christians in the 20th century.
This was the kind of a point of view I come around to think after reading Charles Colum and also David Wim Hof, you know,
yeah.
About these understanding the American system itself and how it corrupts you. Corrupts a lot of Catholics. It bought, you know, the upward mobility, you do well, the American dream, and that itself distracts you from the real goals in life and the destruction of the confessional state. And now we have a pope now which says, you know, that a confessional state is now obsolete. The American system is the best. You look at America and say, is this the best? You know?
Yeah. It's definitely better than England, though, Theo. No, I'm joking.
I probably wouldn't disagree with that. You certainly have more of a healthy spirit of resistance. I think there's still some fight in the American people. I suppose... That's, you know, to draw this back to COVID, what's kind of slightly disappointing is there hasn't been as much sort of red state resistance to some of the absurdities as I would have hoped.
Well, what happens is in America is it's so big and the lockdown isn't universal. It's in California. It's in increasingly liberal Virginia. It's in Minnesota, New York, you know, and New Jersey. The Rust Belt states and these things where you go to Florida or Texas, it's more reasonable. So it's not like in England where it's more unified. So resistant to it is it's all over, but it's spotty and people are experiencing it differently, you know.
Yeah. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I don't know if there's any parting thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with. I would just say that, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the perfect service of Christ is perfect freedom, or devoted service of Christ, and faith, which offers us eternal life. It helps people to accept temporal death as normal. And the fact there are so few people around that I think embrace this, believe, has allowed this totalitarianism to grow. But only those who conserve in their depth of their souls the joy of serving the Lord are ultimately victorious. And this time offers a period to offer great mortification and sacrifices and penance for the reparation of our sins. And I think we are living in, if not apocalyptic times, but certainly times that Our Lady of Fatima's various Marian apparitions spoke about. I don't think it's a coincidence that, for example, about a year before the virus supposedly originated in October, you had the idolatry of the Pachamama idol in St. Peter's in the Vatican, an acceleration of chastisements from God ever since.
And the strange burning of Notre Dame Cathedral on Holy Week in 2019, right?
Yeah.
Was that 2018 or
19? 19.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely – that was one of the things I was going to talk about, but I guess that'll be my parting – well, my parting comments on that. If you look – I would just encourage people real quickly to look and see at the individuals who've committed a lot of these, like, statue beheadings of Our Lady or Our Lord, or it was a migrant, a Rwandan refugee who was set fire to Nantes Cathedral. Look at some of the symbolism there behind some of the names and dates behind it. I don't want to get too, you know, crazy on that. And then also, like, you know, the possibility that these people, supposedly crazy people, could very well be paid just as much as, like, people were getting PayPal to go to the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota and protest a pipeline that would interfere with the rail system owned by Warren Buffett, I believe. I'm serious. And then the Indians eventually kicked them out, all the protesters. A lot of people didn't realize that. I was actually living in that area at the time, and the Sioux tribal leaders came and just threw out all the bums and Antifa people. The same people that get, like, PayPal'd to go, like, set a car on fire or something like that in Kenosha.
Yeah, by the way, police can investigate that, you know.
Yeah.
If they want to.
Yeah, it's – and so
– and then go to the source, you know. Yeah. Go to the source, you know. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think that there is – our enemies are much wiser than us as in general and know and take these things very seriously. I mean, I'd look at E. Michael Jones's video on why – is it really the case that St. Louis, King of France, was persecuting the black community in some way? I mean, I think he did. He led a crusade to North Africa, I believe, but it was failed ultimately in the end. But yeah, I mean, this stuff is being orchestrated. We might think, oh gosh, you know, some crazy Muslim or something like that burned down Notre Dame Cathedral. But, you know, there are people who have a very strong historical memory and they are angry about stuff that happened like 800 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they hold grudges. Very long memory. Yeah. So, okay.
Thank you, Theo.
The mystery of iniquity. Thank you very much, gents.
Thank you.
Should we finish with the Paternoster?
Sure.
In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, amen. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. That was very, very elucidating. Covered a lot of ground there. I've got a bit of a problem. I'm actually doing this on my work laptop, so I can't upload YouTube videos. My personal computer broke recently. I'm looking at getting another one in the next couple of weeks. So I will upload as soon as I can. You're welcome to upload in the meantime, if you've made a recording or use this recording. But yeah, thanks very much for your time.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
Keep up the good work. God bless you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Good night then.
Night.